Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, in part, what we'll be talking about is telling about women's involvement in politics going back some way in America. And at least part of our focus here is on the period before the Civil War, and certainly this was the period before women had the right to vote. In fact, it was a time when American women really didn't have much in the way of civil rights, but one right that they did have was the right to petition Congress. And women in the hundreds of thousands used that right to ask Congress to abolish slavery. Perhaps not quite what they had intended by giving women this right to petition, but indeed they did that. And it was one of the first times in America that large numbers of women came together in an effort to influence national policy. We will talk a little bit about this, about women's political identity in the years before the Civil War, with our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Susan Zeske. She is professor and chair in the Communication Arts Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she's now here visiting the campus, spending some time to give a talk. And this is part of a series that we here on the program have been following along here over the past few months. Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds is what they have called it. And a lot of these programs and a lot of the conversations here that we have with the guests really did focus on Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln as a presidential orator. We have talked about the way people spoke, that is political speech of the time, what was so special about Abraham Lincoln. This is going to be the last talk in this series, and the focus is maybe a little bit different, still making contact with Mr. Lincoln, but going in perhaps some slightly different directions. And this the talk that our guest will be giving is this afternoon at 3:30 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus, sponsored by the Lincoln Bicentennial Committee and the offices of the Chancellor and the Vice Chancellor of Public Engagement. And anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. Here this morning on the program, as well, we welcome your questions and comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you certainly should feel free to join the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I am delighted to be here. Thanks so much, David.
I think that this is I'm really glad that we could have the conversation, and I've been very interested in talking with some of the other folks that were here and having the opportunity to talk about things like political speech in the time of Lincoln and how he was an example of his time and in many ways perhaps stood apart a little bit from his mm-hmm. time. But I'm also glad to get into a little bit different area, and particularly to talk about involvement of women in politics mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. Which, as I said here, you know, that I expect that there would not have been very many avenues for women to be involved in an organized way in politics.
That's right. In Lincoln's world, there was no Sarah Palin. In Lincoln's world, there was no Hillary Clinton. And that is to say that in the political process for the, you know, the presidential election, or even, you know, the senator of Illinois or a state senator in the state legislature of Illinois, women, of course, didn't vote at the time. But that's not to say that women weren't important in Lincoln's political world. And the book that I wrote about anti-slavery petitioning figures largely in the talk that I'm going to give this afternoon. When I do an analysis of Lincoln's 1842 temperance address, because temperance, like anti-slavery, was a movement that women became involved in, you know, a reform movement of starting really in the mid-1820s and through the 1830s and increasingly being connected to political causes such as the Whig Party. And, of course, Lincoln was a Whig, a member of the party that started in the early 1830s. So that instead of having, you know, a Hillary Clinton or a Sarah Palin, you know, on the platform running for president as a candidate, women did not have the right to vote. And indeed, as you mentioned in your introductory comments, David, the idea of women petitioning was also a fairly unique idea. Before the anti-slavery movement, women had only petitioned really for individual causes. A lot of women petitioned, for example, after the American Revolution, after the Revolutionary War, when they lost land or animals or they provided services to the army, and they needed to petition the new federal government to have money or some relief, let's say a pension fund if they lost their husband. But see, these were individual prayers or petitions for individual concerns. And women hadn't exercised petitioning in this country for a sort of a political cause, for a cause that involved national policy. There was only some brief petitioning that had to do with Cherokee removal. But anti-slavery petitioning, is, as I argue in the book, was an opening wedge for women to start exerting their collective influence on national policy. Yeah.
And is it, just to make sure people understand it, what it sounds like it is, that it was some sort of statement that, say, we, the undersigned, request, entreat, you know, whatever sort of language they would use, the Congress to, in effect, to deal with the issue of slavery and to abolish it, and then people would sign on to it. Was that essentially what we're talking
about? Absolutely. And that form, you put your finger on something that was absolutely crucial about why it was petitioning that worked as an entering wedge, because it was a petition in which there was supplicatory language. You know, you really, you are praying to a higher power. And I traced the roots back really into the form of Christian prayer. I even compare some of the petitions to the Lord's Prayer. So women who were considered to be more religious at this time, and, you know, and religion was more in the domestic sphere and therefore considered more appropriate for women. So they took advantage of that form so they could kind of cloak their petitioning as a religious duty rather than as a political duty. But it also, as you said, was, you know, a form in which there would be the prayer of petition addressed to the Congress, usually the House of Representatives, and then the women would go out in the community or at various types of meetings and circulate the petitions and gain signatures. And one of the most delightful experiences I had have had as a scholar was when I was writing this book, and that I got to go to the National Archives and look at all these signatures of women, you know, all these thousands and thousands of women's signatures. Sometimes they just made their mark because they were unable to write, and even their fingerprints, you know, because of the ink, you know, the ink that they used to use were on these petitions. And they would get so many signatures that they would literally sew the paper together with thread to hold them together. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, this must not have been when whoever would decided that women would have this right, that is the right of petition. I don't imagine this is exactly what they had in mind. If previously it was used by individual women who had something in their life, they were looking for something from the government. Mm-hmm. Was there someone or a number of women who said, who looked at the right to petition and said, hey, here's something that we can use. We've not done it before like this, mm-hmm. but why not take this very important issue that we're concerned about, mm-hmm. and then go out there and get as many people as we can. And I know that there was a man who signed on to these mm-hmm. things too, mm-hmm. but go out there and get as many people as we can to put their names on it, and then we'll go and take this to the Congress. Mm-hmm. How did that get started?
Right. Well, there are sort of two ways of answering that. One is that petitioning, as opposed to the right of suffrage, really was considered more of an organic, inherent right in mm-hmm. practice. You know, in, for example, the First Amendment, the right of petition is there. And women were doing these individual petitions, but when they started petitioning collectively, that's actually when it became challenged. Like, should women be allowed to do this? So, in other words, the right mm-hmm. was that they had the right, that it was part, that any person, and in fact, John Quincy Adams, when he's defending women's right of petition in the Congress against the Southern slaveholding members who were trying to keep the petitions down, keep them tabled, he would say, you know, the right of petition is the right of the lowliest inhabitant. And even, you know, even someone with questionable citizenship rights, he was arguing, has the right of petition. And there was also a huge debate about, do slaves have the right of petition? But it was considered more of a, you know, an inherent right that everyone has the right to express grievances. Indeed, the Declaration of Independence of the nation was considered the culmination of petitions not heard by the British government. So again, it's a rather inherent right. But also, in answer to your question, the second part is that British women were petitioning before American women. In the 1828, 1829, 1830, 1831, massive petitions were gathered by the women of Manchester, Birmingham, and other cities in England against the slave trade that was practiced in the British colonies. So William Lloyd Garrison was over there, and he noticed this, and he was kind of sold on the notion of petitioning. And also there was correspondence between American women abolitionists and British abolitionists, and that's where the idea came.
Yeah. So what was the response of the Congress?
Well, the response of the Congress was less than welcome because there was, of course, a vested interest, particularly by Southern slaveholders, but also slaveholding members, but also Northerners who did not want to upset the Union, to risk civil war, to squelch these petitions. And men and women petitioned. But when women started petitioning, it just tremendously increased the number of anti-slavery petitions that were sent to Congress, and it sparked debate about slavery. And again, there had been, you know, a silence about slavery in Congress for about 50 years. So just getting the debate about slavery moving in Congress was a tremendous accomplishment, and the petitions did that. And also, ultimately, in the House of Representatives, the response was to pass a gag rule. It was called the gag rule, to immediately table the petitions without affording them a hearing. And this was a tremendous mistake. It made a martyr of the right of petition, in fact. And so Northerners became upset that the right of, you know, the First Amendment rights, the right of petition, the right of freedom of expression, was being squelched in order to safeguard slavery. And then they had something more in their vested interest, their rights, their First Amendment rights, their constitutional rights. And then the ball started to roll, right? Because then they could say, you know, there was a notion of a slave power conspiracy, that in order to preserve slavery, the rights of Northerners are going to be sacrificed. And it made it all the more potent.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Susan Zeske. She's a professor and chair of the Communications Arts Department at University of Wisconsin-Madison, and is particularly interested in her work and things like rhetoric, gender, political culture. Her first book, the one that we've talked a little bit about here, and if you're interested in reading more on this, you look for the book. It's Signatures of Citizenship, Petitioning, Anti-Slavery, and Women's Political Identity. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2003. She's here visiting the campus to be the final speaker in the series Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds. We've talked with a number of these people here over the past few months. She'll be talking at 3:30 this afternoon on the campus in the Levis Center on the third floor. And if you're interested in stopping by, you certainly can do that. And questions on the program are welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. How many of these petitions were there and how many people signed them?
Well, there were so many petitions ultimately sent against slavery and the slave trade and to, you know, get rid of the gag rule and things like that from about 1820 up through the 1850s, that according to the lore of the National Archives, a room the size of a college dorm room, you know, and I don't know, maybe that varies here. I don't know. I think we all get this. It's fairly big, you know, if you're thinking about just stuffing it completely full with paper. Would be, you know, exceeded in capacity by the number of petitions that were sent. So there were hundreds of thousands of signatures on these petitions, actually millions. We can't know for sure, however, because there were so many petitions that at one point a clerk that was working in the National Archives started to use these petitions to heat. He threw them in the stove to heat the room that he was staying. So, you know, a number of them were destroyed. But I did go through. It took me 5 years to look through all the petitions that I looked at. And the earliest one that I looked at was from 1828. And the latest ones that I looked at were actually, well, I even extended past the Civil War to the nurses and things just to look at what, you know, they were petitioning for benefits and rights after the Civil War. But you know, they came from all over the North. There were a few from the South. And what I found is that there were the forms of petition, you know, in other words, the actual language, were often circulated in anti-slavery newspapers, so that there was only a certain amount of variation in what the petitions said, though they did change over time. But the same petition would be circulated in you know, the language of the same petition would be circulated in different cities all over the North, and then, you know, thousands of signatures.
Well, that's interesting. It makes me think of the strategy that now public interest groups use, where they send out emails or letters and they say, here, copy this, sign it, and send it to your representative.
Right. Yes, it's, you know, it is a notion that, you know, it's a very democratic notion that there's a way to quantify public opinion. And indeed, if you put your signature on something, like, that is representing your personhood and your opinion to a leader, either to an opinion leader or a political leader or an elected official. So, you know, and at the time, in the 1830s, we witnessed the growth of the penny press, the mass circulated newspaper, the more quickly printed novel and everything. So it's not like the 24-hour news cycle of the recent election, but in a way it is somewhat equivalent in the history of, you know, if we talk about a massive explosion in the use of popular media to both measure and represent and inform public opinion. That's what's happening here, and I think that's what petitions did. And it gave people something to do, to be involved, you know, to stay involved in a campaign. I think that the Obama campaign was able to, you know, capitalize on that notion as well, like, you know, giving people something to do, always to be either, you know, emailing someone or participating in a local, at the local level in a campaign. And what the abolitionists figured out is that if they had people signing petitions, they might actually believe that they were making a difference and therefore, you know, buy into the cause a lot more.
Well, that gets at the next question that was in my mind. And particularly given that at the time, for women particularly, they didn't have a lot of avenues for political participation. They certainly couldn't run for office. They couldn't vote. There might have been limits on even their ability just to stand up somewhere in public and give a speech or say, this is what I think. Do you have some sense of what the ability to do this, to sign your name on that petition and know that it was going on to Congress, how people felt about that, how women felt about that in particular?
I looked at not only what the petitions said themselves, but also articles in newspapers that were written by and about women, and also speeches that some women who were leaders in the abolitionist movement gave, and pamphlets that they wrote and circulated. And that's what I used as the, you know, data or evidence to draw my conclusions on what impact there was on women's political identity from participating in the anti-slavery campaign. And one of the things that I found throughout all the different types of discourse, you know, whether it was a newspaper article, the petition language themselves, or the appeals, was that as women participated more and more in the petition campaign, they actually seemed to increase the strength, or the, I would even say in some ways, the sort of the assertion that they did have a right to influence policies in Congress. They would say, you know, we are, in the beginning, their language was very supplicatory, and it was really quite a bit like a prayer, like the Lord's Prayer, where they spoke in ways that acknowledged the power or implied that the House of Representatives, members of the House, were much more powerful than they were. But as time went along, they were, you know, saying, you are responsible to us, and we have a duty to God to save our sister slave, and therefore you need to listen to us. In fact, ultimately, the women were asserting that they were morally superior to members of Congress, and that the members of Congress ought to listen to them, because otherwise the nation was in moral trouble. That they were not doing what was in the House of Representatives was not doing what was in the best interests morally of the nation, and there would be consequences.
Well, did this kind of involvement of women in politics around this particular issue, did that help sort of lay the groundwork for later political campaigns like the one for the right to vote?
Oh, yeah, I think that absolutely it did. And in fact, you can see there are at least two ways that is the case. One is that the same forms, the form of petition and some of the very same arguments were used in the struggle for the right to women's suffrage and the rationale. We need to have the right to vote to make changes in the government and in policies Sometimes this was argued for moral reasons. Another thing that happened is when John Quincy Adams was defending women's right of petition in Congress, he actually asserted in 1838, he said, should women have be denied the right of petition? Indeed, should women be denied the right to vote? I mean, he said this in 1838, you know, well before, you know, Seneca Falls or 1848 and the women's suffrage movement. And it really inserted into the debates in Congress for, I think, really the first time, the issue of women's rights as citizens. And after that, of course, Adams was loved by the women of Massachusetts because he defended their right to petition, and they had big parties for him and things like that. Of course, he was the son of Abigail Adams, right? A very strong woman figure in the early Republic. But it actually raised the issue. And then ultimately, there were abolitionists, people who worked in the anti-slavery movement like Susan B. Anthony and also Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others who would use the petitioning as a strategy in suffrage. So some of the big suffrage parades that we see even up until the 19-teens, they're carrying around giant petitions and holding them up to say, look, this is how many people support women's suffrage. So there's a transfer.
It's very interesting that, you know, clearly at this time, slavery was the big issue. But also, it seems that at that point, certainly there were people and there were women and other people who were talking a lot about that issue, or at least raising the question, well, should women have the right to vote? Should they not have the right to vote? It's not something that I guess I think of as being that much a matter of public debate at the time, since it was probably an awful lot of other things were eclipsed by the other issue and then by the war.
Right. Well, it's also interesting that the another way we can see the anti-slavery petitioning have an impact in the growth of women's political involvement. There's not necessarily, you know, we don't have to see it as a, you know, an arrow that directly connects petitioning to women's suffrage or women's petitioning to the struggle for the right to vote, but also being involved in the anti-slavery campaign, being abolitionists and being involved in other reform movements led women into party politics, because by 1840, with the rise of the Whig Party and really the rise of the two-party system, we see an increased involvement of a certain type of women in political activism. And it's that type of women that was involved in reform efforts, namely in anti-slavery and temperance. So while they don't have the right to vote, they become involved in political parties. And I've argued that Martin Van Buren's run for a second term in office was upset and ended unsuccessfully. I believe because there was such a large influx of women's involvement in reform efforts and also the political celebrations and campaigning of the Whig Party. And that, of course, touches on Lincoln, right? Because he's emerging around at the same time and was supportive of women's suffrage as a Whig.
Maybe it would be interesting to talk a little bit about temperance as an issue. And the reason I raise the question is that some people, when they hear that, they may think, well, that's just about alcohol consumption. But that's really, though, we're talking about something much larger than that.
Absolutely. Right.
What are all the many dimensions of that?
Right. The temperance movement arose it was institutionalized in the formation of the American Temperance Society in 1826. And a lot of this interest in temperance resulted from a number of tensions in the early Republic. One was a massive increase in alcohol consumption in the period of the American Revolution. I mean, just a tremendous, I think it was like every person of, you know, what we now consider drinking age was drinking like 14 gallons of ardent spirits per year, which is, you know, more than 4 gallons more than what we on average consume now, including not only ardent spirits, but beer and wine. So there was a lot of, there was a true problem with the consumption during that time. But there were also crises that were related to the industrialization and what that did to the nature of work. And in other words, a shift from an agrarian economy to a more commerce-based economy. And that created different work experiences and even experiences in place, in relation to place and land, particularly for northern men. And it resulted really in a crisis of masculinity, or a changing type of masculinity, because, again, with the movement away from agrarianism and, you know, people working more as clerks, for example, you know, how does a man behave in the city, basically, in an industrial city? And all of those things get mediated in the temperance movement. Mm-hmm. A lot of those anxieties are mediated there. And as I said earlier, the temperance movement arose at a time in which there was a massive increase in really in the media, you know, in what we ultimately know now as, you know, the blog. You know, this really was the mass production of temperance novels, mass production of penny press newspapers devoted to the temperance cause, entertainments, and so forth. I mean, the temperance cause, like, actually P.T. Barnum was involved, you know, at a certain point. But there was such spectacles of temperance rhetoric, you know, propaganda and behavior. So it grew very quickly throughout the country. And it had to do, because it was linked into issues of alcohol, generational shifts, shifts in the nature of work, and the shifts in gender, it really had to do with the presentation of a different type of manhood and womanhood. And particularly for men, gaining control over the abusiveness, you know, the abuse and overuse of alcohol. And one of the things I'll talk about this afternoon is, you know, when Lincoln was talking about temperance in his temperance address, he was talking about temperance, as you're implying, David, with your question, temperance in many, many different ways. Temperance in one's masculinity, how one was a man in the world. Temperance in one's consumption of alcohol. Temperance in one's self-expression. Temperance in the use of guns, tobacco. You know, cigarettes and things like that. Yeah. So you're right. It had to do, and Lincoln is ultimately concerned with temperance in public debate, public discourse.
Well, in asking the question, I'm thinking also of how it played into the issue of gender and of power relations within families. And maybe also how it could maybe connect to an issue like domestic violence, mm-hmm. and all kinds of things like that
absolutely.
That in a broad way had to do with women, their place in society, their place in the family, and basically the very idea of that women have rights.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely. So one of the things that we see in John Quincy Adams' speech defending the right of petition, you know, in 1838, and I also see this in Lincoln's rhetoric, is the construction of a type of restrained manhood that, you know, presents arguments in a way that invite response that goes to the healthiness and of the Constitution and of the collectivity, and is open to response, as opposed to some of the Southern firebrands who were responding to the petitions and, you know, tabling them, just simply mm-hmm. saying, you know, this is an insult to the honor of the South, therefore we shall not hear it, and throwing it on the table. Okay, but also in that same sort of discourse of honor, reifying the Southern women in a way that cordons her off from public participation, because it would be beneath her. On the contrast, by the contrast, we have Adams, who is defending the right of petition and saying that women actually can bring something to the public sphere. Now, it's not this, he doesn't argue for women's participation in the public sphere in the same way as men. They inherently have the same kind of rights as men under, you know, theories of liberal democracy. Adams doesn't go that far, but he does say that women have a kind of moral superiority, and that they therefore have rights that are connected to their morality, and that they should be allowed to participate in the public sphere. And he says both in terms of petitioning and voting. But that Whig, you know, and of course Adam was, you know, is not a Whig, but at this point, but he's moving in this direction, and at least ideologically, opens up an opportunity for women's participation and for arguing that there is a basis for granting women's rights, and that there is nothing inherent, they're not missing something inherently as political subjects that keep them away from rights.
Yeah, and in fact, and this was something that I suppose you could perhaps argue it has pluses and negatives, but does reflect this, that what had been the belief for a long time that women were somehow the moral conscience of society, that moral values were embodied
right
in them. That was sort of part of their nature. Right. It was just something that came with being a woman.
Right, right. Yeah, that's been called, a rhetoric of benevolence, right? So where women assert some sort of superior moral status to men. And there certainly were many arguments during that time. You know, we have, another piece in this puzzle that we're talking about, and this affects Lincoln's world, is the revivals of religion that happen in the starting in the 1820s and beyond, where people really feel more, leaving the kind of Calvinistic, perspective behind, that they are saved and that they are innervated, energized by that news of being saved. So, women, more than men, are filling the pews of the churches, but they are using the claims to their superior morality and superior religiosity to make arguments for, intervening in the public sphere and in public policy. But, so they use religion. One thing that I thought was very fascinating about when I read these petitions is how these women used religion that had in the past been confining to open up possibilities, to argue, to justify for their right to participate in the public sphere. And sometimes that worked, but it had its limits. It was a strategy that had its limits because it could always be turned around with a passage from St. Paul saying, you're not supposed to speak, right? So they had to fight for new interpretations of the Bible.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, is Susan Zeske. She's professor and chair in the Communication Arts Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's interested in rhetoric, gender, political culture. Her first book, Signatures of Citizenship, Petitioning Anti-Slavery and Women's Political Identity, looks at the anti-slavery petition movement that here was in the United States before the Civil War, and how much women were involved. She's here on the campus. She's giving the final talk this spring in a series, and we've talked with some of the people who are here to be guests in this series on Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds, and she'll be talking this afternoon at 3:30 at the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor, so anyone's welcome. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. In some of the other conversations I've had with people from this series, we talked about political rhetoric in Lincoln's time, a little bit about some of the conventions, and have talked some about how Lincoln embodied the conventions of his time and yet went beyond them in a sense. And that's part of the reason that we maybe resonate with him a little bit more than with other people of the time. He was somehow in his mode of expression, it seems a little bit more contemporary somehow. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about women and maybe their rhetorical style.
Mm-hmm.
And was it different? Was there something that was particularly unique about when they took to the public sphere and they were speaking about political issues?
Mm-hmm.
Was there something about that really distinguished female speech from male speech?
Mm-hmm. I will say that I don't think there's anything, inherently different. In other words, that women are a certain way or men are a certain way. But I will say that given the constraints that were placed on women as public speakers and their constant need to justify their presence on the platform, I think that changed the way that they spoke. Now, having said that, certainly when someone like Frederick Douglass or other African-American men took to the platform in the early period, right, when people weren't accustomed to seeing black people or thinking that black people should be speaking in public, they faced rhetorical constraints that it made it necessary for them to do certain things to justify their presence and also to assert their credibility. So, again, I just want to be clear that I'm not asserting some sort of essential, you know, womanly style in speaking. When I look at, for example, the speeches of Angelina and Sarah Grimke or Frances Wright, someone who spoke a little earlier on a number of topics, including anti-slavery, I see by necessity a defense of women's right of to speak, so that when men would start speeches at this time, the convention would say, you know, you've probably heard, as unaccustomed as I am, you know, blah, 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 right? You know, I mean, that kind of formality where you would actually downplay your credibility, even though you were a speaker of great power and a statesman or an orator of great status, you know, you're downplaying. But a good hunk of the speeches that you read, good beginning chunks are devoted to defending women's speech, and often they are invoking the Bible, a Christian liturgy, or particular interpretations of their own of the Bible. Now, the exception is Frances Wright, who was a Scottish woman who came to the United States in the 1820s, and really was, I would say, more of an 18th century figure in the way she spoke, because she believed in Enlightenment rationalism, and she just seemed to think she could get up and start talking and reasoning, and that people would listen to her. But in fact, she was roundly criticized as a Jezebel, as the red harlot of infidelity, and you know, this had to do with some of the things she was talking about. She was advocated free love, but she didn't take the time to defend her speaking. So it wasn't couched in the more acceptable language of religion, which, again, I see that as a very, you know, particularly defining characteristic of early women speakers in the U.S.
Well, if I'm remembering right, with her, though, she was actually a very popular speaker and made a living public speaking. And with the time when in America there started to, that was a kind of thing where people, for purposes of entertainment, it's maybe difficult to believe that now, but people would go hear political speeches because that was a form of entertainment. And at the same time that there are people, and Frederick Douglass would have been one of them, and I think she would have been another, who actually made a living as public speakers and would go from place to place. Mm-hmm. And there would be places set aside for these kinds of events where sometimes people talk about politics and sometimes people talk about social issues, and people would give lectures about natural history and all kinds of things. And that she was someone who actually managed to make enough money from giving those speeches to support herself and was quite a figure at the time.
Right. Well, she predated the Lyceum. I mean, the stuff that she gave in the 1820s predated the Lyceum, but she did have a series of lectures that she gave, you know, going around particularly, you know, Philadelphia, I think Cincinnati was another city, and Boston, another more eastern cities. But you're right, she did gain, you know, people came to see her, but she was really considered a spectacle. You know, they came to see her, you know,
like, because she was notorious,
because she was you know, I mean, they it was less about you know, sort of listening to what she had to say and take it seriously. I mean, some people certainly did, but I mean, it was so unusual to see a woman speaking in public. And this is, I mean, that's significantly different. We're talking about Frances Wright in the mid 1820s and really up to 1830. It's different from the 1840s or even, you know, by the late 1830s, there's been more women speaking in public. But for someone like a Quaker woman like Angelina Grimke, who wants to make a point about anti-slavery, she, you know, she didn't want people to sort of see her as a spectacle. I think she wanted them to hear her message, and she was a hired agent of anti-slavery societies, but she wasn't sort of trying to make a living in the same way as Wright.
Well, that's I think that's really it's interesting if you think about all of these. Women's involvement and women's involvement in this issue in particular, how that had some larger effects about the way people thought about women and their role in society and whether or not they should be involved in politics, and whether or not they even should stand up in public and give a speech. It's for us now to imagine being at that point, it's probably kind of difficult.
Right. Well, there's an interesting story related to that, and that is that, you know, the anti-slavery movement wasn't exactly in favor of women getting up and giving speeches either. So we have Theodore Weld, who eventually marries Angelina Grimke, writing to her and saying, you know, you should be thinking about the cause of the slave, not the cause of the woman, you know, and like maybe it's not the greatest idea that you go out and give these speeches. And some argue that he married her to get her off the platform, you know, to get her off the speaking circuit. And then she did disappear, though. She would send, as the women's suffrage convention started happening, she would send correspondence to them. But she did effectively disappear from the platform.
Again to introduce our guest, Susan Zeske. She teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's on the faculty of the Communication Arts Department. She's here visiting the campus to take part in this series that we have followed along here over the past few months, Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds. And as I've said, a lot of these programs really focused on Abraham Lincoln and political speech-making of the time. And this is a little bit different in a sense, the talk that she's going to be giving today at 3:30 at the Levis Center on the campus. So anybody who was interested in attending should certainly feel welcome, and questions are welcome too. The 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. To go back to the anti-slavery petitions for just a second, you talked about how many there were. Lots of people signed them, and there were lots of them, so much so that the paper really piled up.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine there are probably a lot of members of Congress who were pretty annoyed and would just wish that it would go away.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever really, or was there some point at which the members of Congress said, well, we can't just continue to say this is beneath our dignity to respond to this and toss it in the trash? Did they in fact have some effect, maybe beyond just getting the ball rolling in terms of talking about the issue?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, they had a tremendous effect. One of the, you know, the arguments I sort of spell out in the conclusion of the book is by, you know, first of all, they were constantly arriving. And mm-hmm. What the Northern members who were in favor of, you know, presenting the petitions would do is they'd let them stack up on their desk, right? So they were a physical presence in the chambers all the time. So they were always there, and the specter of them was always there. And then the fact that some of them were presented, and in fact, as the gag rule was passed, what the abolitionists did was they figured out ways to sneak these petitions in. The way they would write them, they completely shortened them. They used to be long in the beginning, mm-hmm. but after the gag rule was passed, mm-hmm. they would write them so that someone could stand up and say, "I have this petition against slavery," blah, 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 and then the gavel would slam, you know, but it was there, you know, it was already there. And, you know, people were like, "Oh, you know, slavery again." So that was another way that it was done. But I think the most important thing that it did was that it yoked the issue of slavery with the right of petition, with the First Amendment. And members of, you know, the public in the North who really maybe didn't care so much one way or the other about the question of slavery cared about their civil rights, about their mm-hmm. constitutional rights. And abolitionist discourse advanced claims of a great slave power conspiracy that in protecting slavery, attempting to protect the institution of slavery, Northern rights would be, you know, gobbled up, chewed up. And in fact, when the gag rule was passed, it was evidence. It proved evidence to this claim. So it actually made more people in the North sympathetic to slavery, and I think that was, you know, one of the major things that it did. And then, of course, just the, you know, the door to door effect of people going around knocking on doors and talking about the morality and immorality mm-hmm. of slavery, I think made a huge difference as well.
How did people feel about that if they here where there were women? And I assume that they were indeed going out with the petitions, going door to door, trying to get signatures.
Yeah, they were. You know, some people were very unhappy about that. I read some very interesting biography, you know, like memoirs that these mm-hmm. women who were petitioning, they would write, "I had to do the most odious thing today. I had to, you know, gather signatures on anti-slavery mm-hmm. petitions. How I hate doing that. When I knock on my neighbor's door, they tell me that I am promoting miscegenation." And, you know, I mean, they... told them that they should go home and have their father look after them. I mean, it was ugly work. I mean, because the you know, it wasn't just the issue that was at question when you knocked on someone's door. It was your, you know, what are you doing out and about in the neighborhood? I mean, that was considered unladylike. And then to talk about a political issue was considered inappropriate. And, you know, so they were really, these individual women were really pushing the boundaries by doing it. Now, not all petitioning happened in that way. I mean, some of it was door to door, but other things happened, like at sewing circle. They would take the petition and pass it around at church, things like that.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left. We talked a little bit earlier about speech making in Lincoln's time, and particularly this difference where men, especially if they were well known and noted, had to start out by displaying humility before they went in and did their thing, and that for women, they had to start out by justifying being there in the first place, establishing the fact that they had a right to be there, and it was appropriate to do that. And if, and I don't know if this is, you know, pushing too much the boundaries of what you do, but I guess I'm interested in gender and political rhetoric today. We're past the point where a woman has to justify her being there to speak, but I'm sure that there are different, you know, audiences still have different expectations of men and women. And there's still a fair amount of baggage that has to do with gender and so forth. Is there still some kind of hurdle you think that women who are involved in politics have to get over, just at least initially, to be heard and establish their right to speak?
I think that the major barrier right now, or the major issue, is the creating a balance between assertion, the need to be strong and assertive, and being accused of being too strong and assertive, right? I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton is the example. I mean, you know, I think that she, look, if you have a Secretary of State, do you want her to be demure and not, like, being out there in the most aggressive way, in the most strongest way, you know, for your nation, right? I mean, that's the job of that person. And yet if she does that, I think then she gets called back. And, you know, we know the kind of the B word and other things that are used to describe her. You know, contrast that to a Nancy Pelosi, who's actually sort of capitalized on the persona of a grandmother. I mean, she's not even just a motherly. Like, if you know, when you start being motherly, you give up a lot of power, basically, I think, especially in a political arena, because it's a nurturing role and so forth. But I think Pelosi has capitalized on something that, you know, it still has. It's a very gendered role, very, you know, female, feminine role, but also has, I mean, a grandmother still can claim wisdom, and also a certain amount of aggressiveness, because you're old enough to not have to worry. You know, so I think she's found a very useful way of negotiating this. But I think it's still a problem, and it inhibits public discourse. During the vice presidential debates, how far could Biden go in attacking Palin, because she was a woman, and she was portraying a very traditional, you know, like I would say, you know, really past persona of femaleness.
Yeah. It's interesting, not too long ago on the program we had a conversation with Gwen Ifill.
Oh, yeah.
Who has now written this book about the generational shift in style and strategy of African-American politicians.
Right.
And profiled a number of them. And one of those that she actually profiled was Barack Obama, although it wasn't – there was a lot of hoo-ha about this book before it was published. It's not really just about him. It focuses on four in particular. And we talked about, you know, this. Particularly, we talked about race in the recent contest. But we also did talk some about gender and about how those two things became very hot issues, and people weren't exactly sure how they thought about them and weren't exactly sure how to talk about them, and how people were trying to sort out their competing feelings about having a person of color as president, having a woman as president, and those two things sort of battling out. And I guess what it suggests is that, yeah, as intense as race is an issue in America, gender is still a very intense issue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was a very that was a very difficult time to, you know, I think a lot of people were very, very torn about that. And people, I actually had, right before the primaries, I had dinner with Gloria Steinem, and we did some talking about this. And, you know, she was very, you know, I think she came around and rallied the party in the end. But also, you know, I think it's, you know, it's hard to give up if you've been fighting for, you know, women's issues and feminism. Do you want to see someone like you who looks like you and kind of understands your causes in the White House? Absolutely. Is that true for African Americans? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, mm-hmm. where do we go with this? So no, it's hard, but gender is still there, and so is race. And that's what I'm most concerned about, and I know many people are, is that just because we have an African American man in the White House doesn't mean that we don't still have issues related to race, whether they have to do with communication or otherwise. And I also think there is a great deal of, you know, issues about gender that are unresolved, and they were just glaring in the campaign, and I hope we keep talking about them.
Yeah, she says that, and this is no surprise, as she has gone around talking about her book, the thing that people keep asking her is, what's the next breakthrough? You know, they want her to, and obviously they're thinking about Asian Americans, they're thinking about Latinos, they're thinking about women, yeah, particularly, and there's still this notion that there's, it's almost as if, you know, there are a limited number of chairs. Mm-hmm. And people are fighting for the right to have a seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and it's, I think, you know, people have compared it to what happened in the 19th century with, you know, the enfranchisement of the black man, you know, before the enfranchisement of women. And, you know, why, you know, it's, you know, I don't know why we didn't learn the first time, and we could do a much better job of resolving some of these issues. But what, you know, to me is of great concern is that ultimately all of political dialogue, it's not, you know, it's not just about women, although that would be perfectly good enough, you know, because that's a lot of important people, mm-hmm. right? But I think that the debates overall suffered because of suppositions about femininity and masculinity, particularly in the vice presidential debate. So I do hope that, you know, they'll be interrogated more thoroughly before the next election.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. Our guest, Susan Zeske, is professor chair in the Communication Arts Department at University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's here on the campus to give the final speech this spring in the Lincoln's Rhetorical Worlds series. She'll be talking this afternoon at 3:30 at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. And if you're interested, by the way, in this subject that we've talked some about, the anti-slavery petitions, you can look for her book, Signatures of Citizenship, Petitioning Anti-Slavery and Women's Political Identity. That was published a couple of years ago by University of North Carolina?
North Carolina,
North Carolina Press. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.